I've been playing a lot of Battlefront recently, and I play Bossk a lot, you know, the, like, big lizard bounty hunter, and he sounds like he has fucking mega, like, typhus. Every time he speaks, he's like, I'm Bossk.
I didn't know that.
It's so great. It's absolutely fantastic.
I played him once or twice.
I love Bossk. He just is like this nasty, nasty lizard man, and I relate to that. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Out of Phase, presented by Portland State Professional Sound. I'm, as always, your host, Drew Hafner, and I have today someone who is becoming the co-host, because he's here again, everyone. It's Storm. Hi, Storm.
Hey, I was going to say, like, you're always Drew, but I'm sometimes Storm. Sometimes
you
I don't know who I am, I guess, you know?
Sometimes I become someone else. But anyway, today we're talking about the Woodstock Festival at Storm's request. So why are we talking about that, Storm? Like, where does your interest stem in that?
I kind of just thought it'd be a good idea because, I mean, it's pretty relevant to music. And I've been thinking, as I'm sure a lot of other people have, the longer that we're under, you know, pandemic life, the more I'm thinking about how much I miss concerts and live events and stuff, so.
The more that sitting in the rain with, like, several hundred thousand people not being able to hear the music sounds actually like a good time.
Yeah, because at least it'd be something other than just the inside of my house.
Yeah, this cinder block room that I've been stuck in.
Oh, yeah, it is cinder block.
Yeah. So we're talking about Woodstock. We're talking about, like, its history and, like, the its culture and its impact and stuff like that. So if you haven't heard of Woodstock, which I'd be surprised if you hadn't, just based on, you know, the demographic of this podcast, it was a music festival, a three-day music festival that took place in the summer of 1969, so during, you know, the hippie movement and the counterculture movement, all of that kind of stuff. That's kind of become this metonym for the hippie movement. Like, we see it, you know, and its impact, and I'm sure we'll get to this, but we see the use of the term Woodstock to be, you know, this catch-all for the hippie movement. Like, the term Woodstock child or Woodstock generation is pretty common to refer to that kind of group of people. So it's this big, like, iconic thing, more so than basically any of the other music festivals that were really similar at the time. So it, like I said, took place in the summer of 1969, specifically August 15th through the 18th. It was supposed to be in the actual, like, Woodstock, New York area, and it sort of was. It ended up being held in Bethel, New York, which is about 40 miles from Woodstock, but, you know, relatively in the area. And it was sort of held there partially because a lot of people, like, it was part of that kind of counterculture scene. Like, Bob Dylan was famous for living there or having a home there.
Yeah, I guess they really wanted him to come play.
And he didn't, which is funny.
Yeah, but I was seeing some mention that part of the reason they put it where they did, or where they ended up, was so that they hoped that he would be like, well, I'm only like an hour away, I guess I might as well go.
Right. The band did end up playing, though, which had close relation to Bob Dylan. It was held on a dairy farm in Bethel, which I think is funny for some reason that it was just, I mean, like, where else are you going to have, like, this a massive, massive festival other than on, like, massive property, which in, you know, rural New York is farmland. So it was held primarily on this guy whose name is Max Yasker's farm. It was sort of on other people's property and, like, people weren't too happy about that. But he seemed pretty on board with it being there. And we'll get more to, like, how it ended up there in a little bit. But the way it came about was basically because of four key figures, four, like, entrepreneurs, music scene, concert planner, that, you know, like, entrepreneurs in the music scene. So Joel Roseman and John Roberts, two New York entrepreneurs, they were building Media Sound, which was a studio in Manhattan. And while they were doing that, two other people named Michael Lang and Artie Kornfeld approached them and asked them if they would help build a studio basically in Woodstock, in the area near Woodstock, to capitalize on the amount of people that knew it as a part of the music scene in New York. Instead, Roseman and Roberts counter-proposed, no, we're not going to help you build a studio, so let's put on a big festival, like a concert. instead. And they kind of rolled with it from there. They had some trouble finding acts for the festival to begin with, because, you know, it's kind of hard to go, we're going to have this big festival if you don't have anyone. Like, if you're a massive band and no one else that you recognize is on the roster, why would you join? But Creedence Clearwater Revival, a name that I'm so happy I said correctly the first time. I find the words Creedence Clearwater Revival really difficult to say in quick succession. I don't know. I almost always say Creedence Clearwater Revival. Creedence Clearwater Revival. Reviral.
I think it's pretty easy. Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Well, you forget that I'm an idiot and don't know how to speak the English language. Creedence Clearwater Revival was kind of the first big act that jumped on, and after that it was pretty easy, it seems, to find people, because Creedence Clearwater Revival was and remains to be a massive specter in the industry. But they also, they ended up landing, just in case you aren't aware, acts like Santana, The Grateful Dead, Janis Joplin, Sly and the Family Stone, a personal favorite of mine, The Who, Jefferson Airplane, The Band, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, which is just Crosby, Stills, and Nash, but with Neil Young,
mm-hmm.
and also another personal favorite, Jimi Hendrix.
Who could forget?
Who could forget that? He also apparently only played to a crowd of about 30,000 people, which is still a lot of people, but when you consider that there was like 500,000 people there, and he was like the last act to play on the last day, so people kind of stayed until they saw him play a little bit and then left. So he played to a considerably smaller crowd, but it's definitely one of, if not the most iconic performance from that concert.
I didn't realize that there were so few. I knew that it was towards the end. It was like in the wee hour, the early morning hours of Monday, technically. So it was probably like after midnight, but before sunrise, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, late that evening, slightly into the morning.
Yeah, so I didn't know that he played to such a small crowd, but I think definitely it's one of, it's the most iconic performance from there.
Yeah.
There is, like, Jefferson Airplane's performance and some other ones that are really big, too.
Yeah, I always, whenever I think about Woodstock, I think about the national anthem that Jimi Hendrix played. I think that that's not a unique experience. I feel like a lot of people, that's, like, the standout thing I think of when I think of Woodstock.
I think it's the best performance of the anthem ever.
Personally. It is. It's very good. But yeah, large groups. One of the things that's really interesting about Woodstock to me, too, is that even though it was August, which, I mean, I'm not from New York. I don't really know what the weather's like really there at all. But it was garbage weather. Like, just terrible, like, pouring rain. And there had been a rain recently, so it was, like, muddy and gross. Like, it was not great. And because there was all of this rain and thunderstorms, like, certain acts got delayed, so famously Creedence Clearwater Revival didn't play until like 3 a.m. like, that's when they started their set.
Wow.
And then, like, if you look at the, if you here, I'll pull it up because I have it up here, but if you look at the roster of, like, people who played, like, there are some people who started, like, the Grateful Dead started playing at like 10:30 p.m. and played till midnight. Creedence Clearwater Revival I was wrong about that, but they played until 1:20 in the morning. Sly and the Family Stone is the one that I was thinking of. They started playing at 3:30 in the morning.
Wow.
Yep. And played until 4:20 in the morning.
Prime time, huh?
Here's the one that's wild. The Who, one of the biggest bands of the time, massive success, played at 5 a.m.
Damn.
Can you imagine seeing The Who play at 5 a.m?
Usually the only thing I'm seeing at 5 a.m. is my computer screen or the back of my eyelids, so.
Right.
Nah, that'd be pretty cool, but weird.
It's really, really strange, and the notes on this Wikipedia page say that, like things about, like, oh, this was delayed, and, like, this was moved up for this, and all this kind of stuff. Basically, like, this entire festival, from a logistics standpoint, seems like it was a complete nightmare.
The Who were one of the biggest acts at the time, right? Or did they become bigger after?
I'm not exactly sure, but in the late 60s, they were well known. Like, they were a headliner at Woodstock.
Yeah, that's what I figured. It's interesting that they ended up getting pushed back to 5 a.m. because I feel like in modern day they would just cut opening acts right. or something just to make sure that they meet their
I'm not
time.
Sure. I don't have an exact answer on that. But it also could just be like, I don't know. The attitude surrounding the planning and execution of this festival seemed to be the most like, I don't know, fuck it, whatever. It's very surprising because we both work in obviously working smaller concerts than this. But like, I've never been like, oh, yeah, they can just go on in an hour and a half. It's like, no, dude, we've got like a schedule to stick to and we got to stick to it.
Yeah, I guess I mean, if you're intending to sit somewhere like as an audience member for 3 days and just I guess you probably I wouldn't care really if a band got messed up time. I'd just switch. I'd be like, okay, I guess I'm not sleeping until tomorrow, you know?
Right.
Just stay up till 5.
One of the other things, like, speaking of all this rain and this muddy terrain and, like, horrible conditions, the actual venue itself was kind of on rocky ground throughout the planning process. Like, they didn't really nail it down until pretty late in the process for, like, planning the event. So it was supposed to originally be in the town of Wallkill, New York, which is a little bit closer to Woodstock, if I'm not mistaken. But the town board was like, no, you're not doing that. They basically passed a resolution that was like, you have to, at the time, the event planners thought that there would only be about 50,000 people that showed up, which is still an immense amount of people. But, the town board of Wallkill was like, no, you need a we are passing this resolution that says you need a permit for more than 5,000 people. And they were also the authority that granted the permit. So they were like, we're not granting you a permit. So basically made a rule and then used it to not allow people to come.
Fun.
By the time they moved it to Bethel, they didn't have time to build fences around the venue or ticket booths. So it just kind of became a free concert. They were like, we're not going to be able to stop people from getting in, so we might as well make it free. I don't really know what that's, because people had bought tickets for it, and they were expensive. They were, when adjusted for inflation, they were like $130 to $170 bucks. So like expensive tickets at pretty good price for a 3-day concert featuring like massive artists like this, but still, that's not. It was 18 in advance, 24 at the gate, which translates to in money adjusted for inflation. It was 130 in advance and 170 at the gate.
I would pay that.
So
for
a lot.
I mean,
right?
That's for a three-day festival here.
Yeah.
EDC, like a 1-day ticket was like upwards of $300 a few years
right.
ago.
Right. So it's not. That like $130 is a good seat at a one fucking headliner show in the modern time. Like I've paid $90 for nosebleeds, you know, to see one or two bands.
Yeah, most of the concerts I go to are smaller, so I love that aspect that I get to see almost all my favorite bands and for sometimes like $20 a ticket. Usually, sometimes right. I've been to like $15 shows where they just ended up like hanging out with a band afterwards, which was sick. But it wasn't even like only local bands. These were bands from other countries. It's just that they're part of a demographic that's, you know, it's under.
I feel like there's this weird disparity between like moderately successful artists and incredibly successful artists. Because
there's such a
I paid like $100 to see Arctic Monkeys and it was like a shitty ticket. Like it was not a good seat.
Yeah.
And I paid like $20 to see a band called Joywave that I really like. And they're like not unsuccessful, but they're not as big as Arctic Monkeys, but like right. I paid $15 to see bands that I know are making a significant living off of it.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But,
I know they're making a living off their music. It's just interesting that like, you know, that somehow despite their success, I'm still only paying like pennies,
right.
It feels like for a
like
ticket.
I yeah like there are it's bands great. That if they were like, oh, we're gonna charge $40-$50, I'd be like, yeah, no, I'd pay for that seems reasonable. I wouldn't pay $150 to come see you at the Roseland in this like small venue, but
there's a few times I've been tempted to buy like VIP tickets when they're offered, and those are more like the $150 to $190. But a lot one of those in particular for a band included like like a hangout session with the band was included in that ticket price, where you would just play Super right. Smash Bros. With them, like before the set, because like they're huge. It was we reviewed Chon. We did a review for them over the summer at my request of one of their albums. But yeah, and I was so tempted, but I decided not to because I just was
that'd
like
be really great. Though.
I don't want to just I don't know. I didn't want to just be weird, you know. I didn't want to end up being weird and then have it be a bunch of money to just be awkward. I don't know.
Right. So this show is basically like this, like it has this like crazy historical significance. And then if you actually look into it literally at all, it's this mess, like complete mess, like completely unsanitary, disgusting, muddy, logistical nightmare that people paid for. And then it ended up being free anyway.
Yeah. I was reading that, and maybe stop me if you're about to explain this, but like because of the lack of oversight or just planning based on how it worked out or things didn't work out, they didn't have like food or drink, so Max was was supplying free water from his own property's well or something, and then there was like nice people there were people that were pissed off, but there were people that were accepting of it in surrounding communities that were bringing food and blankets and stuff and just sharing them with people for free, which is great.
Yeah. The town of Bethel was, like, not really psyched about it broadly, especially, like, the town, whatever, governing body. But in recent years, they've leaned into it a little bit more. Like, in the last couple decades, they've been like, yeah, this is where Woodstock was instead of not. Because, I mean, the concern for them after the festival, obviously, other than the immediate aftermath of it, was the fact that people would then just kind of, like, come back.
Yeah.
And there would be, like, thousands of people that would just, like, fucking chill in this farmer's backyard.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, it's now become, like, a big tourist thing, and it's, like, this world, or, it's, like, a heritage site, like.
Basically,
so, you know, they make money off of it.
Yeah, I was gonna say, they lean into it once they realize, wait, we can just profit off of this.
Yeah, exactly.
And that sounds bad, but it doesn't, I guess it depends. If it's just lining somebody's pockets, if they're using the profits and supporting the town and, like, using it for public works and stuff, that's a good use.
My last thing about the history of this, because it's such a weird story, is something that I learned in doing this that I had no idea was the case. Apparently, although it was a very peaceful festival, which with 500,000 people is remarkably almost, impressive.
I mean, sadly, almost unimaginable in like
unimaginable, especially world. By today's standards.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, like, I've been to fucking concerts with 300 people where someone gets punched. Like, yeah. So anyway, I mean, maybe kind of a sign of the times, peace and love, whatever. But according to Wikipedia, there were two fatalities that are recorded from Woodstock. One from insulin usage. Okay. Don't know if that's deliberate insulin usage or, like, recreational.
Recreational insulin
that
usage.
Was, I don't know. I would assume
is
not,
that a,
but it's Woodstock.
Is that a thing?
I don't. There's no way it is. I clearly neither one of us are diabetic.
It makes no. I mean, I have a good friend that is, but I don't even think. I wouldn't ask him I don't imagine he would just know off the top of his head, oh, yeah, plenty of people just ask me for my
recreational
insulin. Use it. That's weird.
The other fatality was, this is horrible, and maybe tragedy plus time equals comedy a little bit with this, but still pretty bad. The other fatality was caused by a tractor which ran over someone that was sleeping in a hayfield.
Ooh, that sucks.
Pretty fucking gnarly.
Yeah.
There also were apparently two births at the event, one in a car caught in traffic, and another in a hospital after someone had to be airlifted out of the festival.
Wow.
And this is the wildest part. There were four miscarriages. I don't understand how all of that happened in 3 days. I guess, like, the law of large numbers, statistically speaking, it makes sense. But
yeah,
that's crazy.
Like 500,000 people.
Yeah, if there's five, if there's quite literally 500,000 people. Like, yeah. Anyway,
isn't there?
You look confused.
I'm just trying to. I don't know, and I don't want to look it up because my keyboard will just makes a unadulterated amount of noise, so I'm not going to, but I think that there might be states that have less of a population than 500,000 currently.
I believe that.
Maybe not. Maybe I'm fudging them a bit, but there's definitely small cities. There's definitely small cities that have a population of less than that.
Well, let's think about this. Portland's population is about 450,000 people in the Portland metro area. Or no, sorry, in Portland proper.
Yeah,
not the Portland
I was going to say metro is... Metro.
Metro is about 1.2 million, I think, or 1.5 million.
Yeah.
The least populous U.S. state is Wyoming, with about 578,000 people.
Okay.
So, ridiculous.
Almost the population of Wyoming.
Yeah.
I'm sure at the time, Wyoming's population was less.
Yeah, exactly. But larger than the population of Guam and the U.S. Virgin Islands and American Samoa and the Northern Mariana Islands combined. I imagine there's no one has any reference for the population of those four places because... I don't.
Interesting. That's a lot of people.
So, it's a lot of people. It's a lot of people. When they originally expected 50,000, which is ridiculous. It's the size of a middle-sized city in the United States.
Yeah. Just on a dairy farm.
Too many people. On a dairy farm. Just hanging out in good old Max's backyard. So, Storm, what is the, like, cultural side of this?
Well, there's a lot of angles. Obviously, the fact that we're talking about it right now, and that probably, again, everybody who would listen has heard of it at least multiple times, shows how much of a significant event it was. At the time, you know... The promoters didn't envision as this thing like you were talking about. They wanted another concert. I had read that they were trying to use this concert and then take the profit from it to then build the studio that they wanted to do eventually.
More or less, yeah.
Basically, you know, it was never intended to be this huge thing, and I think if you tried to make it that, it wouldn't have ended up working out anyway, because it seems like the more forced something is, the less, you know, relevant it ends up being when it comes to, like, I don't know, stuff like that. But basically, right. I've heard about it my whole life. But one angle that I was exploring through some reading some other people's thoughts on it and some, you know, some history behind it as well, I hadn't thought about it in that I think its largest cultural shift or it was a catalyst where the mainstream popular culture after Woodstock shifted to be about the younger generations as opposed to the parents of the generations that were the ones, you know, providing for them. Like, you know, if you look back to like 50s and stuff, mainstream is more about the family unit and like the older division. You know, it's like parental and, you know, there's nuclear families. That was a huge part. Maybe that's not pop culture, but I mean, pop culture as we know it now, part of it is because of the way Woodstock affected the time. And it was this huge culmination of all these things that were going on. Like you mentioned, you know, there was the war in Vietnam. There was, you know, the civil rights movement was just a few years past. There was all kinds of social unrest and not just unrest, but good things too. You know, there was this hippie generation. There was the make love, not war, you know, sentiment and the counterculture. But what Woodstock did is it took that counterculture and propelled it into the mainstream spotlight and gave it a platform with which to, like, show the world, like, we are upset with these things, we don't think they're okay, and this is how, like, we're going to talk about them. But it was, part of what made it so special is it wasn't just a soapbox. It was about, like, just being real, sort of, you know, and letting the things happen as they were. And so, you know, a lot of the acts were, you know, use their music as forms of protest, you know, like Bob Dylan is a pretty decent one. I mean, maybe not protest explicitly, but, you know, Bob Dylan's music definitely brings ideas that aren't necessarily pleasant to everybody, but makes praise, you know, there was a lot. And then especially the biggest one we were talking about, like Jimi Hendrix's rendition of The Banner. I mean, that was obviously, it was done beautifully. So it wasn't like he went out here and he just, you know, shit on the whole thing, right? You know, but he definitely put a lot of angst and disappointment and emotion into
it. Yeah, it's not hyper-patriotic.
Yeah, I mean, he emulated, you know, in the way that Hendrix does, one of the things that made him the most special was creating different sounds out of the guitar. And so he used his guitar and effects, like the whammy bar and stuff, to emulate the sound of bombs dropping or the feelings of anxiety and tension and war and stuff. And that's something that actually I never realized until only about a year ago when I was in a theory class and my theory professor mentioned it. And I was like, wow, I don't know why I never thought about that. I just thought it was cool, you know, that he was doing all this crazy stuff. But there was a real reason behind it. So, and what a lot of people talk about who were, you know, a lot of people, I mean, obviously it's very well known for, you know, the other hippie side of like just drugs and sex and rock and roll. But there's a lot of people out there, maybe even a majority, that's not even the main takeaway. The main takeaway was just how they showed that as big a number of people as we were talking could show up and coexist peacefully for a weekend and take care of each other and show genuine, you know, love for each other, even though they didn't know each other and they may not even know each other as soon as the festival ends. You know, they might just totally go their separate ways. But yeah, it really, really propelled the popular culture to be helmed by the younger generations going forward. I mean, after that, you know, and they tried to do similar things with other Woodstocks in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s.
I find that idea so funny.
Yeah.
Because that seems like, I don't know a ton about them, but that seems so doomed to fail in a way,
exactly.
Because the whole idea with Woodstock is that it was very organic. Like, I mean, yeah, it was put on by music festival producers and stuff, but still, it kind of snowballed into this massive cultural phenomena.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to articulate, I guess, earlier. Is the fact that it was so organic is, I think, the main reason why it was so, why it's remembered so, like, why it became such a big thing. You know, if it was not planned in the way that it was, you know, if they had, you know, said, oh yeah, come here and like absolve your differences and do all these things, I'm not saying that that wouldn't work or that's a bad approach or anything, but it wouldn't have been as special because it didn't just happen, right? Like this wasn't supposed to be this thing, but people showed up and that's how it ended up working out. So, you know, you have this environment that was created just through, you know, people's will to enjoy music together and show it as a form of protest and also care about each other and talk about, you know, most of the younger generation, you know, because of the way pop culture was, they weren't listened to as much as they are now after Woodstock, right? A lot of the music, like I said, was protest and was done by people, and a lot of the reason they were there was to kind of take a vacation is not the right word, but kind of soak in all the horrible things that were going on in that time, as well as the good things. I mean, one thing that's really, really cool example of how the whole event ended up being, as I was reading Max Seasgard, he was actually very conservative politically, and he was, at least I saw one source say that he was pro-war, even. But he was not the type of person to judge others or oppose them because they thought differently than he did. So he allowed it to happen on his farm, even though the main, you know, draw was, you know, this counterculture and this anti-war sentiment and this free love and you know, the Woodstock generation, all the things that those are. And the event took place on a dude's farm who was pro-war and conservative and not even the liberal. But he, again, you know, in the true spirit of Woodstock, he thought, well, that there's no reason they can't have their fun, and like we can't just coexist, you know? They disagree from me, but that doesn't make them bad people. And I think that was pretty cool too, like, because I never knew that. I hardly knew anything about Max before this, but I'd heard the guy's name, I think, once or twice.
One of the things that I found really interesting about him, and this conflicts a little bit with what you're saying, so one of us is probably wrong a little bit.
That's fine.
But there's this quote that I found from him that he basically, when asked to talk about this and this experience, he said, if we can join them, we can turn those adversities that are the problems of America today into a hope for a brighter and more peaceful future. And regardless of what his political views are, I think that's a good sentiment, that he's like, hey, These people are caring and care about the future of the United States. Great.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate that, well, this isn't a political podcast, but yeah, I agree. I think that's a really good way. You know, even if people disagree, if you want the same thing out of genuine, you know, goodness, it's a shame that so many people can't see that or won't see that and just refuse to work together, even if they have different mm-hmm. approaches to the same goal. Like, you know, it's sad. But yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. But like I said, I didn't look at a million sources, so I can't say exactly, you know, to what extent that is. However, I do think that it's interesting how the focus from Woodstock, or how it was a catalyst for focus to be put on younger generations as far as popular culture, like I was saying. Part of that, you know, was that they realized, or at least some people realized, that could be, you know, monetized, basically.
Yep.
You know, I mean, everything's monetized now, and especially is the Driven thing. But I think it's interesting if you try to think about what makes festivals nowadays different from something like Woodstock. Of course, like we were talking about, Woodstock was special because of, you know, the way it worked out, despite how it wasn't planned to be that way. You know, so obviously things aren't going to be the same. And like with the newer versions of Woodstock that have come out every so often, you know, they're quite literally not the same. I have heard about the original Woodstock, like I said, pretty much my whole life, growing up around, you know, my mom, who's a hippie, and her friends and stuff. But I didn't even realize, I think I'd heard of Woodstock 99 once, but I forgot about it. The point is, I'd heard so little of these other Woodstocks that I didn't even remember they existed until I was looking into it and thought, oh yeah, I have heard that there were other ones. Why do I not know anything about them? Because they just weren't...
Because they were more manufactured.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, festivals are still really cool, obviously. I mean, I haven't personally been to a large festival, I don't think. Mainly ticket price.
Yeah.
As me. And the thing about festivals, I think festivals are really cool because you also get... It's almost like a musical buffet in a sense, you know? You go there and you get... You just have exposure to all these acts and stuff. And that's really cool. Especially, like, if you don't know them and then you like them. But a lot of times, modern festivals, too many of the headliners are bands that I'm just not a fan of, or artists that I just, you know, I like, maybe, but I don't like enough to spend $300. And so, you know, but I've been tempted more than a few times to just go on one day and see, you know, right, just the Saturday show or something. Because that's what I think the majority of people do, right, is they go for a specific day because it's more cost effective and it's also not... Yeah, you mentioned earlier, this is complete sidetrack, but you mentioned earlier about how the traffic, and as I was looking into things, I don't think I'd heard this in particular, but traffic got jammed up so bad outside of, like, on the way to Bethel, that a lot of people just abandoned their cars.
Which I can't imagine helped the situation, quite literally at all.
No, obviously not, but I just think that was kind of interesting, because I imagine being in a traffic jam and seeing other people just getting out, grabbing their tents and shit and walking, and because I would be like, should I do that? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You yeah, would. You totally would.
Wow, I love my car. Like, in the modern world, I don't know if I would. But in the 1960s, yeah, I would totally leave that shit just in the road and fucking go,
yeah, exactly.
What's going to happen to me? There's going to be so much cars there, they're not going to be able to do anything. I mean, it's like you said, they couldn't police the place. I didn't even know that there was tickets initially, because I hadn't looked into that aspect. But I knew that, like, 500,000 people show up, there's no way, there's not a chance most of them paid for it, you know?
Right. I know that, like, they had considered, the New York governor considered dispatching the National Guard just because of the sheer amount of people, and one of the organizers was like, no, that's a bad idea.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of a message would that have sent?
Yeah, not great. It would be really on brand for the U.S. government, though.
Oh, for sure.
Apparently, during the festival, though, people from a nearby Air Force base were, like, on call to airlift people out if necessary. So, yeah, that, I think, is one of the things that is the biggest takeaway from this entire discussion, is simply how massive this group of people was, and also how not an issue, broadly speaking. You know, like, I can't think of in my lifetime any massive gatherings like that that are just good. To be fair, in recent memory, most massive gatherings are protests, which are very different from a concert. So it's maybe a little biased for me to say, but like the amount of just social cohesion necessary to keep a small city in check, a medium-sized city even, like, is baffling. It's quite impressive that the culture of peace was so ingrained into these people that they were just good hanging out.
Yeah,
that's half a million people.
That's what I was just going to add to that. You know, it starts with the people, the individuals themselves that are there. It never would have happened that way if everybody was real ornery right from the get-go or something. And, you know, some of them did have, like, you know, I mean, again, with all the problems there, in Vietnam protests, you know, there was the, like I said, civil rights was just a few years before that civil rights movement. So there was still significant, you know, there was like Black Panther movement, like there's a lot of things. But everybody who went there from the standpoint, or I guess I can't speak for everyone, but obviously.
Yeah, it's hard to speak for 500,000 people.
Obviously the vast majority, based on the fact that there weren't any significant issues or violence or any of that crap, you know, went there understanding that, you know, you kind of leave that, you check that shit at the door, basically. And like, you just
check that shit at the door.
You know? And I'm sure it's also easier, you know, when a lot of people are high on acid or marijuana or various other drugs that tend to not make you not violent. Maybe if you take 500,000 people and give them a bunch of PCP, I would never do that.
Yeah, give a bunch of people just a bunch of angel dust, some ketamine.
That would be some violent shit. Well, it could be. I guess PCP doesn't have to make you do that. I've never done it, nor do I ever want to. I don't know anybody that has.
That's a fair point.
I'm assuming there's people that do it, but I do know, like, in the worst case scenario, people who get high on PCP and then excited delirium, I think is the actual term for the mm-hmm. mental state they end up in, where they kind of turn into zombies and just attack people and stuff. It's nuts.
Yeah. That was not what Woodstock was like.
No, that was not Woodstock. Quite literally the opposite. It was the, you know, the people just being cool to each other, honestly. And man, it would be so cool. I think about that as one of the events. Like, if I could have a time machine and go back to specific points and just to be a bystander and like see what was going on, I would obviously love to go like see Woodstock in person. And I'm sure almost anybody would who's interested in music and or popular culture or some other thing.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but yeah, I think culturally, like I said, the biggest takeaway from it and the reason it's kind of persisted in history is that even if it's not talked about, it really took a lot of the power of social outcry to the younger generation and gave them a lot bigger voice and made people pay more attention to them or us, I guess, technically now in this day and age, you know, that would be us.
Yes, we are technically young still. Well, that's Woodstock. I mean, broadly. Yeah?
Yeah, pretty good general touch.
I think that's Woodstock.
There's more specifics to be known, but I mean, basically, that's the real meat and potatoes of it.
Well, thank you everyone for listening. Hopefully we'll be able to get these podcasts out more frequently. Thanks Storm for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's good to talk to you again. I'm sure this won't be the last time. Well, thank you everybody for listening. This has been Out of Phase.